Donald Freeman, a.k.a. Elder Freeman, is one of the original members of the Black Panther Party of Southern California, along with our apprentice Bunchy Carter, Long John Washington, Roland Freeman, John Huggins, and Tommy Lewis. Ronald Freeman was born in Detroit, Michigan, and moved with his family to Los Angeles as a teenager. He was in Los Angeles during the Watts riots of 1965, and like many young men, was a member of one of Los Angeles' social clubs. In 1967, Ronald and his brother Roland joined the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense that was being organized by apprentice Bunchy Carter, a friend of Eldridge Cleaver and the former leader of the Renegade Slaussons, one of Los Angeles' most prominent gangs. Ronald was an essential member of the Black Panther Party during his formative years in Los Angeles and Southern California. He began as an officer of the day and rapidly moved up in the ranks to serve as the field secretary of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, the second highest ranking position in the chapter. Ronald Freeman was responsible for coordinating party activities throughout Southern California, from Los Angeles down to the border with San Diego. He was a comrade with the leadership core of the party, including our apprentice Bunchy Carter, Don Cox, Raymond Masai Hewitt, John Huggins, Emory Douglas, Erica Huggins, Kathleen Cleaver, Wayne Farr, Harold Taylor, Tommy Lewis, Walter Pope, Chip Fitzgerald, Renee Moore, Bruce Richards, and many others. Ronald worked with long-held political prisoner Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt, who, like many others, was framed under the FBI's COINTELPRO program. When Geronimo was released in 1969, Ronald was there with his brother Roland to welcome Geronimo's release. During the 1970s, Ronald was incarcerated in San Quentin and after his release relocated to the San Francisco Bay Area in 1980. He was a member of the Timers, a grouping of the formerly incarcerated who advocated on criminal justice issues against mass incarceration and for the rights of ex-felons. He later joined with All of Us or None as the outreach coordinator to continue advocacy for the incarcerated and their rights. During the last few years, Ronald Freeman, a.k.a. Elder Freeman, has battled with cancer but has continued his activism around the formerly incarcerated in the African-American community on the need for freedom for all political prisoners and with grassroots issues that impact people's day-to-day lives. Along with former members of San Quentin Six and his Bay Area community family, Elder has organized around the recent California prison strike and supported many different organizations. Elder is a key voice in the film 41st and Central, which highlights the attack by the Los Angeles police on headquarters of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party in 1969. His family has deep roots in the Universal Negro Improvement Association, UNIA, of Marcus Garvey, stemming back to the 1920s. Elder has been a longtime member of the African Orthodox Church. His family includes 3 daughters, 2 sons, 11 grandchildren, 2 great-grandchildren, and a worldwide community that recognizes his lifelong commitment to the Black freedom struggle. Elder, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
How long have you been in the movement? I mean, are you dating your time in the movement from when you joined the party, or how long have you been in the movement?
Since 66, really. I've called myself being in the movement because after the rebellion in L.A. in 65, it's like my whole thinking and change, my mind shifted. And I wasn't just thinking about myself. I was more concerned about what was happening in the community as far as not me just getting a job, but a job being available for other people. So, well, it's simple. If everybody has some money, things would change in the communities. So that was just basically my feeling at the time. And so I started working with other people in the areas of us being able to defend ourselves in the beginning, because I looked at that as the most important thing we needed at the time.
Well, you're born in Detroit.
Right.
What part of Detroit you born in?
Well, the part of Detroit that I lived in as a youth was they called it North Detroit. It was over there between Hamtramck and Highland Park, two little cities they have inside of Detroit. Detroit was segregated. Yeah, I grew up in a black neighborhood.
So when did you come out to Los Angeles? How old were you when you came out to Los Angeles?
16 and 61, I had had my mind-making experiences already had in Detroit on how I was going to go and what I was going to do. I hadn't really made it up, but if one of them wasn't, I wasn't going to be just a laborer in the factory, because that's what happened in Detroit. Going to school is that the teachers say, you know, they weren't teaching us to be engineers and things. They say, just think of what place you could find where you could fit on the assembly line. And I wasn't thinking about being no assembly line worker, and that was supposed to be my whole future. I wanted to design automobiles and do all that kind of stuff. And they telling me to look for my future on the assembly line. So I had a whole attitude about school. It wasn't a good one.
You had brothers. And talk about mom and dad. I mean, why did you guys move?
I guess historically you could see now where the whole thing about the jobs in Detroit and the whole plight of Detroit started way back in the 50s. They started shipping jobs out of Michigan then to other states. They wasn't going out the country then. They was going to other states. So my stepfather lost his job, and you would think it would be easier to find a job again in Detroit, but it wasn't that easy because a lot of businesses was closing and moving. So they wasn't really in no hiring mood. So my stepfather decided to move to California, where he felt he had better opportunities as far as employment and being able to have a better life. So we came to California with him coming out here first and finding he could find a job, and then he brought everybody else, the whole family. Yeah, we came out on Route 66 in a car. We came yeah, like how most people migrate to California. Although we came from Detroit, it was like how people come from the South. We was eating chicken and sleeping in the car and all that stuff, you know. Yeah.
Talk about mom.
My mother, well, she was an extraordinary person. I have to say that, I guess, raising me, for one thing. She was a very outgoing lady. She had a good sense of humor. She would always do one thing that she always liked to tell, because I got a little history in my family where my grandfather and everything was part of the Marcus Garvey movement back in the 20s and 30s. So my mother was always proud to tell everyone she never had a white doll. She never grew up with a white doll. I mean, for someone to say this back in the 20s and the 30s, that their consciousness was at a level to where it's not to have the thing that people was taking for the norm, to have a white doll or a white Jesus Christ on your wall and all that. That was kind of the norm back in the 20s, you know, to have that. And by her to have a black doll, and never, my grandfather would always paint the dolls that was white, he would paint them black. Although Marcus Garvey them did back in that time in the 20s and the early 30s, they did have a factory where they was making black dolls. So it was a level of consciousness that was changing in America. My mother, she would always point out some of those changes that was occurring as far as with the black community, that we had rights and that we need to, and a lot of the things that was happening to us was wrong, and that's how I was raised, based on right and wrong. And if it was wrong to exploit, it was wrong to abuse, it was wrong to murder people, it was wrong for all of the things, that the injustices that was being put upon us as black people, it was wrong. And that's how my mother felt about a lot of it, although she didn't tell me a lot of this until after I was grown and in the Black Panther Party. Some things she didn't tell me because I don't know if whoever wrote it or however people want to look at the Willie Lynch thing, is that there is some, to me, there is some validity, and it takes for us to look at how what it speaks about, how mothers would protect their children and keep things from them. It was all protection, and it was like a prevalent in the community that I kind of grew up in, that people weren't speaking. They weren't speaking out about a lot of things, because I could remember one time when the civil rights movement was going on in the late 50s, because it was all about the movement that they was having and the busing, and they wanted us to go down there. And I just asked them, you know, simple, you know, if they hit me, can I hit them back? And they said no. And I said, I ain't going. You know, so, I mean.
What was mom's name?
My mother's name is Glathy Flowers. Glathy Ann. You know, she had a good country name.
Okay. So you have a brother, too?
Yeah, I got a brother.
Okay.
Yeah, he's 1 year younger than me. Well, I always say that my mother couldn't have twins because she only weighed like 100 pounds. I was going to say 80 pounds, but she weighed about 105 or something. So she couldn't have no twins, so she had one year and one the next year. Because we're only 2 days apart.
Is your brother still living?
Yes, he's living in Los Angeles. He was in the Black Panther. We both joined the Black Panther Party.
Okay. You know, you were talking about the Watts Rebellion. I think I read someplace that you were there. That's the same year, of course, that Malcolm X is assassinated. It's a couple of years after Freedom Summer. What did that do for Ronald Freeman, the Malcolm X? When you were there, you were what, 20 something years old,
yeah,
or so when the Watts Rebellion jumps off.
Right.
What came out of that for Ronald Freeman?
It may sound strange, but a sense of responsibility. I felt I had to take some responsibility for what was occurring in our community. I had to get involved with changing what was occurring with the police, with education, with jobs. Because I come from a community that was a community. When I was a little kid growing up, the neighbors would help look out for each other. Somebody gets sick, people would take care of each other. Somebody had a problem with something, people would assist and help them. So I set aside my own personal desires and wants and start focusing more on the people in general instead of just myself.
That's young to do that, though. Do you have any sense of where that came from? Is it from just because you had a community? Was it something to mom and dad? Was it the UNIA? Was it just you? Was it just what the ancestors wanted for Ronald Freeman?
I guess you could say it's all of the outside influences that was around me coming up. There was a community there. You had the black doctors, you had black professional people. So everybody basically you seen was of were black people. So it was like the grocery stores and place where you had to go do business at. They was all black professional people. The people was telling we could do anything. It wasn't anything that we couldn't do, and we could accomplish anything long as we strive to do that. So I identified with the community because it was more of the people was more uplifting than I was getting at the school. That's what I'm saying. So I end up hanging and running the streets instead of going to college.
Okay, what do you mean by running the streets, Ronald?
I mean, I learned how to shoot dice and play cards and learned a few little hustles. And
were you in the gangs in L.A.?
In L.A., yeah, I belonged to a social club.
A social club?
Yes, same thing, gang, okay. Social club. They basically, you coming together so y'all can socialize, y'all communicate with each other, y'all do things together, y'all go to parties together, y'all fight together. Yeah, you drink wine together, you eat together, all that kind of stuff.
Why did you join at some point the party? Because you joined the party when you were 23. It's not necessarily unusual because a lot of people join the party young. But
right.
What was it about the party that attracted you? Because this has been your lifelong commitment.
I would say at the time it seemed the party had, and it did, it took a kind of a non-compromising position. Malcolm had interjected the whole thing and made it a real issue about our human rights. And it wasn't just about our civil rights, it became also about our human rights. The system is going to respond to us, or there's going to be some kind of action taken other than us just demonstrating and walking up. You know, y'all shooting us down and killing us. Well, there comes a point, if you know anything about mathematics, there comes a point where there's going to have to be a tit for tat, and you got to kind of balance the sheet. You know, so if y'all keep killing us, there's some kind of reaction going to have to happen on the other side where some of y'all going to have to be getting killed. I mean, it can't just keep going on like this. I mean, so with that, the whole thing that there had to be radical change, you know, within inside the black community was something that I wanted to see happen. because they was having poverty programs and a lot of money was poured in. I seen when they poured a lot of money in people acted up. People didn't go along with the status quo and wanted some kind of issues to be addressed, and they wasn't being addressed, like police brutality, and people was getting tired of the police just coming in, beating on people, and just riding herd over people. And if you had a dispute with a grocery store or something, the police would side with the people in the grocery store. So there was a whole dissociation with the community and the police, and they was like an occupying army, which was like a term was used like a lot in the Panther Party, which is was like that. It was like these police and stuff was coming into the community and riding herd on people and going back out. They come in, spend 8 hours, and then go back out. We need a police that's going to live in the community, be a part of the community, and be one with the people. And then you could talk about having some kind of policing. But I was just seeing murders and seeing people being railroaded in the courtrooms, and I had that experience. You know, when I was young, I had got a little case or something, and they went to court. I got up and the police lied. He just lied. He lied about the whole situation and everything that occurred. He just lied. So I realized that the courtrooms is not about telling the truth. It's about who can tell the best lie. Because that's all he did. He did everything he could to make it appear that I was really a tyrant and everything. And I did none of the stuff that the police was saying I did. So it was like I had a whole different disposition about the courtrooms, the prosecutors, the public defenders, that whole judicial process. It was like this is corrupt. And its design is just an extension of slavery, which people have been saying. So a lot of people have been talking in the community. You got to realize, too, the Nation of Islam had been established in the community since the 40s. And they had been really working in the community in Detroit, in particular, since really the 50s. And it was a large segment of them in the community. And so you was always getting that information from the Nation about that black people need to be to do something about changing their conditions. You know, but I wasn't ready to join like the Nation of Islam or anything. But the information that they was giving me was relevant. And it was relevant to all of the people in the community, because what the system was doing was affecting us all. See, I guess I'm like this. I'm a real kind of good guy, and I want to see people. I can look and see that, hey, this is good. I can see where people can have joy out of having a nice house with nice furniture, living good. They be happy people, you know. But people living in the project don't know if they're gonna be able to pay their rent next month. They don't know how they're gonna be able to make. They become very stressful and angry people. So I'm looking at the difference in my community and saying we need to have quality of life in our community. And the whole thing the party was saying, something that always stuck with me, was that if you change the conditions that people living up under, you change their behavior. Change the conditions, their behavior change. I said, that's just, it make a lot of sense.
Joined on Africa Today by Roland Freeman. He is a brother of Ronald Elder Freeman and one of the original members of the Southern California branch of the Black Panther Party. Roland worked with Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt, Prentice Bunchy Carter, John Huggins, Erica Huggins, and many others. Roland was in the Black Panther offices in Los Angeles in December of 1969 when they were attacked by the SWAT forces of the Los Angeles police. Roland, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. When did you and your brother join, Ronald? When did you join the Black Panther Party?
Well, basically, we joined the party, and I guess it was like August or September. I don't really remember, but August, September of 1967. We had heard about a meeting. Me, my brother, and a couple of friends heard about a meeting about they starting the Black Panthers in L.A., and we went over on the east side. and went to the meeting, and that's when I first met Bunchy Apprentice Carter. And it, at the meeting, it maybe about 12 people was in the meeting. Once Bunchy spoke and explained what he was trying to do, then, you know, I had made up my mind that, you know, this is what I had been waiting on. You know, me and my brother. My brother, I was kind of surprised that he joined, but we both kind of joined. But at that time, you couldn't just join the party. You had to come back. You know, you had to make a, it was, you had to take a mile-mile oath, and you had to make a commitment, you know, with your life to join the party. So he told us, like, hey, you just can't join. You know, if you're really interested, then you come back in a month. So both me and my brother came back within a month and joined and took the oath and went forward with it from that point.
Why were you surprised that your brother joined?
Because I was more of a militant than my brother. My brother was kind of, I guess he was a lumpet proletarian type, okay. You know, and he really hadn't really showed that much interest in politics and the struggle and all that. I mean, it wasn't that he wasn't interested, but he was more, you know, on a thug level, I guess, with his thinking,
okay. You
know, so.
What was it about that that made him join then? I mean, you know him better than anybody else. What was it about it?
Bunchy was a hell of a person. Bunchy, and, you know, once I, like I said, when Bunchy got through talking, it's like, you know, it ain't no need me trying to find no other mousetrap or nothing else. This guy got it. He got all the quality that you needed, you know. So I guess at that particular time, it impressed my brother the same way,
okay. You
know. And basically, when we joined, I was working for the L.A. County Welfare Department, so I had a job, but he wasn't working. So once we went back that next month, you know, he started functioning with the party right off the bat on a day-to-day basis. He made up his mind, and once he made up his mind, he committed himself 100% to the struggle, and he never faltered from that point since that first day.
Harold Taylor served as a comrade of Bunchy Carter and Geronimo G. Jaga Pratt, and he worked in the Los Angeles and San Diego branches of the Black Panther Party, or the Southern California branch of the Black Panther Party. Harold's a longtime activist and a member of the San Francisco 8. And he's joining us today to talk about, when I talked to him the other day, he said, I enjoy the opportunity to talk about my friend, my comrade, my good buddy, Ronald Freeman, as we call him, Elder. That was a turbulent time there in the late 1960s. Talk a bit about that in Los Angeles, what it was like being there.
Well, you know, it's it was a hectic time during the time, this is after the Watts riots, and around 67 or the beginning of 68, when I met Ronald Freeman, but at the same time, things were real hectic with the police department. You know, we had a lot of trouble with them. Numerous cases of police brutality, attacks on black people in the black community. When the Black Panther Party came to town back in 67, Bunchy Carter was heading up a party in Los Angeles, which was, he was a deputy minister of defense, along with Geronimo Pratt and numerous other people. And that's when I first met Ronald Freeman. You guys call him Elder Freeman. But me and Ronald became good friends, comrades. You know, he's my brother. Ronald was working as a field secretary. He was basically a field marshal.
Under Don Cox?
Under Don Cox, yeah, basically. We started working together along with his brother, Roland Freeman. And I met them in the office on Central Avenue, 41st and Central. They opened a branch out on 84th and Broadway, which was really down the street from my house. And I became a member of that branch. And we organized in the community and sold newspapers and tried organizing our free breakfast program and implementing some other programs, free clothing drives, community service to the elderly. And we would also do a protection thing of walking them to the bank on days when they got their Social Security checks to make sure nobody tried to snatch their purses or rob them. And basically, we patrolled the community and just kept an eye on the police department whenever they stopped somebody. We would observe them and make sure that people knew that they had the right to remain silent. They didn't have to talk to the police. They were more than given their name. And they didn't have to stand there and talk about anything they didn't want to talk about.
Why did you join the party
Well, you know, it was really 1965, in August of 65, when the Watts riots broke out in Los Angeles. At that time in 65, I was going to Jordan High School. And we would always have run-ins with the police. During that time, Watts was really a pretty tight community. It was mostly black people, nice little shopping centers and stuff like that, shopping areas. And just from my observations from the police and the way they treated us, and if we ever ventured across the railroad tracks on Alameda, which was into the white neighborhood, they called it, named Southgate, I think it's still called Southgate. Police would run us back across the railroad tracks, and, you know, they would say things like, niggas, keep out, you know, you're not allowed over here, and stuff like that. And sometimes they had what they called the spook hunters back in those days. It was a group of white kids or white people that rode around, and they'd come across the tracks, and they'd try to intimidate people and jump on different people. So we kind of countered them with some of the groups that we hung out with, you know. And I hung around a group that was in the Jordan Isle Projects, and we mainly hung out on 97th Street in front of the projects. When the Watts riots came, me and some of my friends, we ventured down there, you know, when they first started. And when we got over there, there was a rock-throwing thing going on with cars passing by, throwing rocks at the police and throwing bricks at the police. And I got the understanding that it was behind the Fry Brothers, you know, where they were trying to arrest them, and their mother came out, and the police department ended up jumping on his mom. And they were brutalizing her, and, you know, it was hot summertime, and being young and not having enough sense enough to be scared, we indulged, you know, me and my group of people, we got involved, you know. We started throwing rocks at the police and doing the same thing everybody else was doing. And I became very familiar with the brutality of the Los Angeles, the sheriff departments, police departments. When the party came along, and you had people like Bunchy that was heading it, whose reputation that everybody just about knew about who Bunchy Carter was, because he was a leader of a gang called the Renegades of Slauson Village. You know, that was a big gang in Los Angeles at the time. And he was recruiting for people in the party. I mean, you know, getting members in the party, getting them interested. And he had just got out of Soledad prison. And he started recruiting for the party. And I had a great interest in Malcolm X anyway at the time. Most youngsters my age and young people my age, young black men, was really influenced by the Nation of Islam and Malcolm's breakaway from the Nation of Islam. And black nationalism was very, very popular at the time. But it was something that drew me to the party was that it stood for self-defense. And I really was taken to that, you know, because I felt like the police department was an occupying force in the black community, and that it was young people's job as well as mine to defend our community and defend our people. Mm-hmm. So that's what my interest in the party came, and it grew as I got in it. Then came the assassinations of members of the party. After Huey Newton had been in jail for a while, then the attacks on the party and assassination of Bunchy Carter, and then the killing of John Savage and the murder of Sylvester Bell and John Huggins and Bunchy Carter was really, I was close to that camp, you know, so I took it very personal, and it seemed like they was trying to crush our party, you know, mm-hmm. And that was the Black Panther Party for self-defense. That was the Black Panther Party that I joined. At the time, they said that you could never join any other organization other than the Black Liberation Army. So one thing led to another, you know.
Where did your militancy come from? Is it family? Is it the way you grew up in L.A.? Is it your time in Detroit? Where did it come from, Ron?
Well, it comes from a combination, you know. It was in the blood, but we didn't really know it. Mine personally came As a youngster, I grew up in Detroit, and you know, Detroit is a racist city, and you know, we lived across. When we finally did move off the east side and move to the west side, we lived across the street where apartments where they had signs for white only and all that. So, you know, and we weren't really into the white folk thing anyway. The civil rights was all good, but we weren't really into eating with them and living next door to them and all that kind of nonsense. But me personally, I all through my elementary, junior high school, I liked history, and I knew history, and I studied history, and so by the time I got to be a teenager, I was pretty well versed in history, and I knew that history that these white people was telling us was just a bunch of bull, and I realized that, and you know, I was able to expand on it. So by the time the civil rights struggle came, like I said, I wasn't into no nonviolent turn other cheek type of thing and getting on your knees and praying to these, you know, because like I said, I knew our history. You've been dogging us and slaving us, raping us, boiling us. You did everything possible, a human being, you didn't dare to us, and now we're begging you to let us have a piece of your cake. So I wasn't into none of that nonsense. But I wasn't, you know, the Muslims and Malcolm X was around, and I was impressed with Malcolm, but I really wasn't into the Islam or the religion or Elijah Muhammad. I wasn't really into that either. So as things progressed, my mother, you know, hey, get a job at the post office. So I went down and took the signed up for the post office, and they signed me up to take the test. And the day I took the test, they had the demonstration at the federal building in L.A. about the Selma, Alabama, where they had beat all the people up on the bridge. So when I went down there to take the test, but they had closed the building and told me they would reschedule my appointment. I'm like, okay. So I was standing in the crowd, you know, looking at the protests and all that stuff, and then about 100 federal marshals came out the federal building, and waded into the crowd. And then as they waded into the crowd and started snatching on people, a bunch of the brothers jumped up and started fighting back. So I'm standing on the side looking at this, smoking a cigarette, and I'm like, wow, these brothers getting down. Next thing I know, here come this black police run and grab me and pull me into the brawl, talking about I'm one of them and stuff. So anyway, they arrest me. With 300 or 400 people got arrested. They arrest me, the civil rights people. They bailed me out. They got me an attorney. The government charged me with whatever, blocking the mail and all this kind of nonsense. So I had a trial. At the trial, the only thing that saved me is that they had a news footage that showed me standing on the side smoking a cigarette, and this guy running, grabbed me and pulled me into the crowd. So the jury found me not guilty. When the jury found me not guilty, this cracker white judge, he turned red. I mean, he turned red. The white man turned red. He told the jury that they're the most lousiest jury he ever saw in his life, and to get out of his courtroom. And, you know, and I jumped up and started to say, wait a minute, man, what's wrong with you? And my lawyer grabbed me and said, hey, man, it's all over. And I thought about it. I'm like, you're right, it is over. So, you know, when I thought about it, it's like, you ready to send me to jail on a federal charge for whatever. I mean, they were trying to give me 15, 20 years or something for something I didn't have nothing to do with. And even if I would have something to do with it, it wasn't trying to do nothing but give people some rights. And so I'm like, okay, you know, my back of my mind, I'm like, you know, if this is what you want, you know, I'll give it to you. So anyway, thing as a riot, that changed a lot of things. L.A. Watch Rebellion, opened up a lot of eyes, a lot of brothers that had been in gangs and, you know, getting high and running the streets and all that kind of stuff, kind of saw, well, wait a minute, you know, this man is not invulnerable. You know, he's more scared of us than we are of him, really. All we really have to do is organize. So you had a lot of organizations and a lot of stuff going around at that time. But at that particular time, I couldn't really find any that I wanted to be involved with. But I had a little crew. It was like me and three other guys. We would go to all the meetings and stuff, and we'd go to the rallies. But when we would go to the rallies, we would take our guns. Now, we had already been impacted by the Panthers up in Oakland in 66, and when they went to Sacramento, but you didn't have anything down here. We was already riding around with our guns and stuff. So when I finally, you know, met Bunchy, and he was starting a party down here, like I said, it that was it for me.
Willie Sundiata Tate, Sundi as we call him, is a member of All of Us or None, which is a group of ex-prisoners, ex-formerly incarcerated people, actively fighting discrimination against people who have done time in prison. Sundi is also a member of the Timers, another group of former Black Panthers and activist ex-prisoners who organize annual events in the African-American community. Willie Sundiata Tate was a member of the San Quentin Six, a group of incarcerated men that were charged with assaults on guard at San Quentin on the same day in 1971 when George L. Jackson was assassinated. Sundi has been very active for many, many years in the Bay Area community and around the country doing work around formerly incarcerated political prisoners and human rights. He joins us today to talk about his longtime friend, Ronald Freeman. Sundi, thanks for making the time.
Yes, thank you for having me.
When did you meet Ronald? When did you first hear Ronald? When did you meet Ronald?
I heard of Ronald in the 70s. I had a good friend named Arthur Lee, and he used to tell me about some of the brothers that was in the L.A. chapter of the Black Panther Party. Some of the brothers in Southern California, not necessarily all in the L.A. chapter, but they were in Southern California. And he would talk to me about Ronald and tell me about some of his episodes, like about him got one leg on the run board of a car and somebody driving. He like dodging bullets and firing back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's when you first heard of him. When did you get to meet Ronald?
I didn't meet Ronald until 1997 after I had returned to the Bay Area. And I met the brother and subsequently, you know, got to know him. We formed a group called Timers. And Elder was one of the primary actors in that movement. And the brother was just a revolutionary and dedicated brother, you know. But when I met him, you know, Elder wasn't a loud person. You know, I met him at a birthday party for Arthur and for a couple other people that had birthday in the month of March. You know, the brother came in, he had his dreadlocks down, you know. Brother looked really sharp and tight, you know. And got a chance to meet him for the first time.
Tell us about our apprentice, Bunchy Carter. So when you joined the party, Bunchy was in the party.
Right.
Tell us about Ronald, Bunchy, your friendship, your relationship.
I met a great man when I met Bunchy, and I didn't know it at the time. Yeah, I heard this call. It was a call that went out in L.A. that the Black Panther Party was going to be forming in Los Angeles and that they was going to have a meeting and all that. So I went to the meeting. Me and my brother went to the meeting. Bunchy spoke at the meeting. He got up and he was very elegant. In a sense, he kind of reminded me of Malcolm because he was down to earth with what he was saying. He wasn't trying to talk over people's heads or anything. He was trying to make it plain so people could understand. That's what Malcolm did for me, is he made it so simple that if I can understand it, anybody can understand it. So that's the way I felt, because I didn't have nothing but a little common sense. I ain't got nothing but a little bit of brain. So I figure if I can figure it out, everybody else should be able to know what it's talking about. So Bunchy, he had this magnetism about himself, and he really he can take the English language and he could be very fluent with it. And he knew how to choose his words and how to put things and all, because he was also a writer. Because he wrote poetry and stuff, and he did poetry. So he had a little gift of gab. He could speak real elegant. And so I liked him. But that wasn't the deciding factor, because it's just like what he did to me, I did to him. It's like by both of us being from the streets, I just checked with my people from the streets and stuff, and they told me all about him, you know. They say, yeah, man, he's the leader of the Renegades, man. The leader, oh, you mean it? That's the leader of the Renegades. I said, oh, okay. Say, yeah, them, okay, they're the ones that took over L.A. The Renegades took over L.A. They said, if you wasn't going to be a Renegade Slauson, you wasn't going to be nothing. And they broke up all the gangs basically in L.A., and it became basically like one social club, and that was the Slausons. I stopped doing it. I went to Hollywood. I'm going to go make me some money out later for this, claiming this territory over here and defending this. I'm going to go get me some money. There's too many of them Slausons. You know, so it was just like gangbanging days was over.
But why did people follow? I mean, you talked about Bunchy being charismatic, but the political part of Bunchy, what was it about Bunchy and the party and what Ronald was thinking in that period of time that made Bunchy a leader?
By that, showing that he got that ability to organize. We ain't got to all go to college and be professors and all that. We got geniuses, you know, that come right out of the street, and he's one of them. And he had the ability to organize hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of young men into a organized structure. Just him. And a couple of more other people from the streets. And he had a structure. And that they had great influence on the whole city of Los Angeles. And then by being in the party, then he takes that ability, and he don't apply it to street life or anything. He applies it for his people. Now he's going to use his talents for the people instead of for himself. And I saw his dedication, which made me become even more dedicated. So his ability to organize and to coordinate things, because L.A. had went from six people to over 500 or 600 people. I'd be saying L.A., and I just correct myself sometimes. I'm talking about Southern California, because the Panther Party went from the Mexican border all the way up to Bakersfield. So it was people that was participating in party activities from San Diego up to Bakersfield, as far as like with breakfast programs and food programs, doing prison work. Like, we got a couple of buses to go take families to go visit the prisons. We used to take the senior citizens to the bank, take them to go shopping and stuff, because they used to get robbed a lot, you know, back in them days, because there wasn't no direct deposit. They had to go get their check, and they had to take their check to the bank. And when they'd be coming back out the bank, there'd be some predator right there to rob them. So we started helping senior citizens with that.
Erica Huggins is an activist, a former political prisoner, and leader in the Black Panther Party. She spent more than 14 years with the Black Panther Party, and I was at times the director of the Oakland Community School in the mid-1970s. During the late 1960s, her and her husband, John Huggins, were members of the Black Panther Party of Southern California. Erica is currently a professor of sociology in the Bay Area. She's taught yoga. She's taught meditation. She was a comrade to many of the leaders of the Southern California Black Panther Party. Prentice Bunchy Carter, she knew, Ronald Freeman, Roland Freeman, Wayne Farr, and countless others. She joins us today to talk about the life and work of Ronald, as we call him, Elder Freeman, and of the Black Panther Party. Erica, thanks so much for making time to talk with us.
Oh, thank you for asking me to be here to talk about my friend Ronald.
A bit of background on you. What was it about the moment, Erica, that made the Black Panther Party something that Erica said, I want to be a part of this? Why did you join?
When I looked at the picture of Huey Newton in Ramparts Magazine in 1967, because I joined the party late 1967, I was amazed that there were young Black men and women who were saying no to police violence and aggression. And that picture stayed with me. I was a student at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania the stopping place for many people, including Kwame Nkrumah and Langston Hughes, and many students who were coming into the United States from Africa to spread out across the country for education. I was one of the first 15 women at Lincoln University, because it, prior to my entry, had been an all-black male school, historical black university. And sitting there and studying, and because I was a part of the student movement on campus, and a tutor in the community nearby, the poor and black community nearby, I thought, I need to be doing something more than being a student. It is 1967, and everything that can move is moving. What am I offering to that? And this was the question many young people at the time asked themselves.
The name Alprentice Bunchy Carter goes with the Southern California chapter.
Yes.
Your impressions, your thought when you met Bunchy?
Well, when we got there, he was still in jail or in prison. But soon after we were there, for maybe even an hour, people began to talk about Bunchy. Something about him when I met him, immediately I was drawn to him. He was brilliant beyond belief, charismatic, in a good way. He didn't use his power, so to speak, to harm. He was both when he spoke, it was like poetry. And I could tell also that the education he had came, some of it came from books, but that he was a self-educated man, which I really respected. The most amazing thing about Bunchy, it was his understanding of not only African-American history, but African history. And in the Black Panther Party, we didn't focus that much on African history at all, but Bunchy was a master. And he'd taught himself all of this in prison. And so whenever he spoke, I listened. When he asked me to do something, I did it. And I always felt that he would never ask me to do something that would bring me or others harm. I say that very intentionally because there is a mainstream, particularly mainstream media, which this is not, understanding of the Black Panther Party as a violent, fly-by-the-seat-of-their-pants kind of entity, and we weren't. Bunchy was very careful and thoughtful in his actions. And he was strong. He could be fierce, but he was compassionate. That was the other thing that I noticed about him. And I'd never met a young black man like him.
I saw an interview where you made it clear that it was Southern California.
Right.
And talk about where there were chapters or activity in the party from Los Angeles, how that looked.
Well, it was scattered, and to me it kind of looked pretty good because it was more than just like one city, because I would go to Santa Ana, I would go to San Diego, I would go up to Bakersfield, I'd go to Riverside, I even went to Santa Barbara. It was a bunch of college students out there that wanted to see if they could start a Panther Party at a little chapter out there. So, yeah, you had Venice, Long Beach, Compton. It wasn't no local problem. It was a national problem that we was having. So to just have a chapter office in Los Angeles wouldn't be sufficient.
Gotcha.
We would have to go where the people is, and the people would people would make those places become active.
Did you conduct the PE classes and the readings and all that? Was all that part of Elder Freeman, the day-to-day work, the reading, the political education, breakfast for children?
Occasionally. Mostly I did was coordinate. I would make sure that we had intelligent people that was running their political education classes. We had people that was running off, people that would go out, people that was running the office, and people that would go out and collect donations. They would be they would all have to have certain kind of characters and dispositions to do these different jobs. So my job was picking out the people. As far as education class, I would, on occasions, every now and then, I would interject myself into them, but we would usually have someone that would be structured to run the class, have an outline on what they was doing. So it was pretty well, educational classes was pretty well organized.
Was there something about the camaraderie that was special about Southern California, or distinctive about
Southern California? Special is a word.
Special. Special, huh?
And I'll tell you why. From 1968 forward in the Southern California chapter of the party, we were a close-knit group. We lived collectively. And the house that John and Bunchy and I lived in, many people lived there. And Bunchy came and went from our house all the time. It was a hub. It wasn't an office, but it was a place where we were the closest, all of us, and the most intimate. We lived collectively, and we knew that we were infiltrated by the FBI, COINTELPRO. We knew that it felt to me that one in every four people was an informant. So we live with that understanding. We live with the understanding that the people who we were eating meals with and sharing sleeping floor space with or sitting in meetings with or reading in political education classes with could be working for the government. It was part of our lives. It wasn't separate from our lives. So when I laughed and said it was special, it really was, because we learned how to maneuver all of this, or where I learned how to maneuver all of this, because it continued when I moved to Oakland after I was released from prison. L.A. was where I grew up, literally and figuratively, in this understanding of how the world really works. Because I do listen, there were often people who would come and tell me, you know, I'm going to leave next week because I came here because the government paid me, but I can't do what I'm doing anymore. And you've been kind, so I'm telling you, and goodbye. I mean, it was like that. They were all young black people, you know, some of whom had prior convictions and had been told if they worked for the FBI, they wouldn't have to go back to prison. They were told all kinds of things. There were addicts who were told, we'll give you drugs for the rest of your life if you tell us what's going on. So it was common to us what was happening. So we were very close. We got to know each other in a very intimate way, though we didn't have a lot of conversation about each other's lives.
You're tuned in to radio stations KPFA, KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, that's 88.1 in Fresno, and online at www.kpfa.org. You're listening to Africa Day and Transitions on Traditions, a special program highlighting the life and work of Ronald Freeman, a.k.a. Elder Freeman, one of the original members of the Black Panther Party of Southern California, along with Apprentice Bunchy Carter, Long John Washington, Roland Freeman, John Huggins, and Tommy Lewis. Why was your brother able to move from, I think, Officer of the Day up to the point that he became a field marshal and worked all around Southern California? What was it about him that gave him those that characteristic that he would be promoted in advance?
Well, he had a tenacious type of personality. He, you know, he used to get into fights and all that kind of stuff, and, he, you know, could pick on bigger kids and all that stuff. It never made sense to me, but, you know, and then he'd get in a battle and, you know, whoop some of them, stand his ground on most of the rest of them. So I guess he had a lot of heart, and it showed, you know. And he, like I said, once he did make the commitment, he went, you know, 100%. He puts the pedal down, and he just went all the way with it and never let up.
When did you meet Ronald Freeman, as he's called, Ronald Elder Freeman?
Yes.
But it was Ronald and Roland. Do you remember the occasion when you met the two brothers? Did you meet them at the same time?
No, you know how when you walk into this building, there's certain things that are always there? There's certain people that are always here. Ronald and Roland were just always there. I don't remember a day without them in Los Angeles. And one of the things that I loved about both of them is their sense of humor. What we were doing was really difficult. To use the word challenge is an understatement. We were challenged every day because we weren't just protecting ourselves from police aggression. We were also trying to provide services to our community. So there were multiple challenges. But the sense of humor, the kind of humor that doctors and nurses say they have in wards where people are very ill, the kind of humor that my Vietnam vet friends said that they had when they were on front lines. So that's what I remember about both of them. And specifically about Ronald, once again, I'm always looking for people whose minds are bigger than what they're told, whose ability to be with people are beyond their race or their gender or their sexual orientation or some small identity that means nothing in comparison to our hearts. And Ronald had and still has a big heart and was always welcoming and friendly. That's my remembrance of him continually throughout the years. Always willing to move forward, too, not holding an old story or a war story as the gauge for a person or a situation.
What made your friendship between you and Ronald Freeman, as we called him, Elder Freeman, what was it between Harold and Ronald Freeman that made you work together and be lifelong friends as you are now?
Yeah, me and Ronald, man, we was attached to the hip. We both tall, skinny, didn't have sense enough to be afraid of nothing, was willing to take chances, and had this undying love and desire for the community and wanted to see something done. Wanted to let the police department know that we were there for the purpose of defending our community and that we was going to represent that to the fullest. Me and Ronald paired up real good together. After Bunchy got killed, Geronimo was picking out a group to go to San Diego to help reorganize the branch down there. And he picked out Ronald, and Ronald immediately named me and four people from my section. And we all went to San Diego to reorganize that branch because it's falling to pieces. And Ronald trusted me, and I trusted the cats that I grew up with. So we was really known to be really a tight-knit group, and there was no history of any informants ever coming out of the 84th Street branch. And we all kind of took pride in that, and we sold more newspapers than anybody else in town. Mm-hmm. Ronald was a big part of that, along with Roland. And everybody contributed. You know, we worked hard together, and we got along real well. We had a breakfast program come off the ground within a couple of weeks in San Diego. And we were feeding something like, in the beginning, something about 20 kids a day, and then it kind of grew from there. And then after you established the breakfast program, we moved on to something else, and we allowed the community to take over the breakfast program.
How did Ronald Elder Freeman stay strong spiritually? I mean, how do you make it through this? Because a lot of lives are lost in this process, and this has been your work for 40 or so years. How do you do that, Elder?
personally, myself, I say, I put it like this, is when you once know the truth, you know, it's kind of hard. I know for me, it's kind of hard for to turn around and walk away from it. You know, once you know that, A, that these conditions and these things exist, for you to walk away and go in another direction knowing that the people's needs are not being addressed, and you know why it's not being addressed and how this whole system is operating and what they're doing, and for you to just say, well, I'm only one individual, there ain't nothing I can really do about all this here, and just say, I know it's bad, and go on, well, I got to live my life. I didn't do that.
But people do that.
Right. I didn't do that. I don't know.
Why not?
I just had a sense of commitment to seeing the things change. If we wait on the system to do things for us, it ain't gonna happen. We're gonna have to start doing these things for ourselves, and if the system can turn around and see through our works and efforts to assist us in those endeavors, that would be great. And the reason why I say it like that, because you can see the sickle cell anemia thing that was, we just all of a sudden it came up and discovered, but it was something that the Panther Party took an interest in and dealt with, and it became a national issue as far as black people having sickle cell anemia and addressing that disease. A lot of money and a lot of research and development that went into it. I think if the Panther Party hadn't got involved in it, we wouldn't have had all that research. We wouldn't have had all that happen.
You know, Ronald, 1969 was taken off. I mean, there was the attack on the office in Los Angeles. There was attacks on Black Panthers by other organizations that exist in Los Angeles. How much of this is just African people trying to figure out the struggle and people having different points of power and self-interest, and how much of it is COINTELPRO?
I'm going to say a lot of it was the police. They just took advantage of a situation that existed, a long-standing, disputes or something that went on back in earlier in the 60s when people were younger. The police was able to exploit where some people that was in the Panther Party and some people that was in the US organization, they knew each other prior to being in these organizations. What the police was able to do, they was able to see that there was a contradiction between the two groups, that some members in one leadership and the other leadership, they didn't like each other. They got the whole thing where they sent cartoons about one organization to another. So they exploited some old feelings that people had that didn't have anything to do with the struggle. It just was personality conflicts that people had. And they exploited that to the extent to where it ended up people killing each other and making people decide to where I don't want to be involved in no social group because this is how people going to act towards each other. It was a situation that I wish that never occurred because although I participated in it, you know, I got shot by other black people and I shot other black people. You know, it wasn't nothing that I'm proud of or something that I would tell people to strive to. We need to be working towards unity more so today as we was then. We got the thing with the gangs now. Then we got the thing with people within the movement. The movement people can't come together on things. So it's a lot of disunity going on in the community where what we need is the whole thing Garvey said back in the 20s. The biggest thing working against black people is disorganization. We disorganize. As long as we stay disorganized, we can't win.
person, his character, the way that he and you knew each other, that allows a person to survive and be sane and adjust to being on the front lines?
We were in cadres. We were comrades. So our focus was what was happening in the present moment. And the thing that I remember about Ronald, and he may have a different impression of himself then, is that, like most of us, he was fearless. And sometimes that was because we were naive about the power and the intention of the government entities to, as John Mitchell said, who was then Attorney General, to wipe out the Black Panther Party by any means necessary. We were somewhat naive about what that meant and how it would be carried out. But still, I feel that Ronald tended to be in the present moment. In those early days of the Black Panther Party, we talked in political terms and often used a lot of rhetoric to describe how we were moving forward. But one of the things that I remember about Ronald is that, and he still is, he was gentle, if that makes any sense to you.
But you knew, or you came through your circles, some of the people who later turned out to be not just us organization, but turned out to be working for the authorities.
Right. We had some, I think, on both sides. I think it was some Panthers that was informers and worked for the police. And I think it was members of not just the US, several other organizations that also worked for the police. So that's an issue just like it is today. My whole thing in dealing with that, if you're going to have talking about being clandestine, you're going to have to be very scrutiny of the people that you associate with. But if you have an open organization, that shouldn't be nothing that you should really be concerned about, because you ain't got nothing to hide. You're out front with everything. So if the police come in, put them to work. You know, just put them to work.
How did you survive? Because in 1969, all these factors you're talking about, and J. Edgar Hoover talking about, the Black Panther Party is the number one threat to the internal security of the United States. The international stuff is jumping off. There are people who have, over in Algiers, there's an international branch of Black Panther. How did Ronald Freeman survive through this period? Because as 1970, here we are 30-something years later, and you're still here and you're still doing work. How did you make it?
Well, I'm going to say the one thing first, back in the 60s, but one thing I did, I limited the number of people that I really put trust in. So I only had a few people that I confided in. So it was only a few people that knew that much about it. They didn't know all of the inner things about me. So as long as I kept my mouth shut about a lot of stuff I was doing, the less people knew about it, the less chances I got to get busted. The people in the Panther Party, like a lot of the ones that passed away in the 70s, a lot of us died in the 70s in Los Angeles. It was a lot of us that didn't make it out of the 70s. And that's another part you could say about my commitment to do things, is that I can't just walk away and leave them brothers and them sisters that gave up their lives, and I just walk away and don't feel a dream. Because we used to talk. We used to talk about how we would, what kind of system we wanted to see, and how we wanted to see society be, and all those dreams and all those fantasies we used to, you know, and be in the houses and stuff. And then they did, and I'm still here. But the ideas and what we wanted to do, still I got the opportunity to work to make those become reality, to make those things that we was dreaming about become reality.
Sisters, Black women were also a key part of the party. How did that...
Yes, they were.
I mean, consciousness around issues of gender change and hopefully continues always to change. But at that period of time, talk to us about how it worked then in terms of how, what we've learned, what we did right, what we didn't do right, with that interaction between men and women fighting for the same cause.
I feel we wasn't real good in that area because it seems that a lot of the men didn't know how to deal with women as being equals. You know, the whole thing with us being raised where the woman's supposed to cook and do all that, and the man is the boss. And so in the party, it was different because everybody was on the same plane, men and women, and that the women, although that was the idea, but in practice, Kathleen could tell me what to do. I would follow what she say to do. But somebody else, Kathleen, could tell them what to do, and they ignore. Women wasn't respected to the degree in the party like they should have been. And we guilty of that. And we always did have Kathleen as a secretary. As far as women being in positions of authority, we always had some, at least that one from the beginning.
How long have you known Kathleen?
Since 67.
Okay. Tell us something about Kathleen. I mean, most of us who see her now know her brilliance and her role, but as a person who was deep in the struggle with everybody else, what impressed you? What are the qualities that remind you of who Kathleen was and what kind of leadership she brought?
She brought a sense of intelligence and balance. So she was a kind of a balance to me. If the women made the party, let me put it like that. We could talk all about all of the men and the old thing, but it was the women that really kept that party together. It was them, their unsacrificing dedication and their commitment to it. They was just unselfish in a lot of things they did. They'd get up and do the breakfast program. They'd get up and go out and collect donations. And they was doing all this unselfishly. And so if it don't be for the women, there wouldn't have been no Black Panther Party.
I always gauge people by how they treat women and children. And I don't remember Ronald being unkind to women or children. And there were people who were. We bring to any room we enter all of our backstory. And I just never felt uncomfortable in his presence. I never felt that he would demean or put down a person for the sake of a laugh or to make himself feel better. Something about Ronald stood out to me that way. And maybe that's why people call him Elder Freeman with so much love and respect. His spirit is really big, and he's not very big. He might be skinnier than me, but his spirit is huge.
Ronald Elder Freeman is the subject of this evening's program. One of the original members of the Black Panther Party of Southern California, along with our Prentice Bunchy Carter, Long John Washington, Roland Freeman, John Huggins, and Tommy Lewis. Ronald was a central member of the Black Panther Party during his formative years in Los Angeles and Southern California. He began as an officer of the day and rapidly moved up in the ranks to serve as a field secretary of the Southern California chapter of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, the second highest ranking position in the chapter. Ronald was responsible for coordinating party activities throughout Southern California, from Los Angeles down to the border with San Diego. The other organizations that the party was working with, clearly some of it was with organizations that weren't African-American. So I'm interested in that part because in some senses that's an era when black and white is a divide, but the party worked with different groups of people.
Right.
White Panthers, the brown,
right.
Spanish-speaking populations,
right.
Asian population. Talk about that, what that meant. how would Elder see that in his lifestyle?
Yeah, well that was a unique experience for me, too. I mean, I grew up as a Garveyite, so...
Okay.
When we formed those alliances with the Peace and Freedom Party, with white organizations, with brown and with Asian, and with the Native American community, when we formed those alliances, that was something that I had never formulated or even thought about in my mind. But I seen, in order for us to really deal with our conditions in our community, we had to have these alliances with other people that's suffering just as well as we suffering. And we got to recognize that we're not the only people that's catching hell. Forming alliances was necessary. You could isolate yourself, but this ain't just happening to black people. It's happening to brown people. It's happening to people of all colors. It's happening to every. It's happening to the elephants and the zebras and the kangaroos.
Okay.
I mean, they ain't just doing it to people. They're doing it to animals, too. So the whole thing for us about uniting was key. And then the people around the world, the whole thing about the position that if we want to correct what's going on in America, it has to have, it has a relationship to the rest of the world. And therefore, we got to form alliances with people that want to see change around the world. So those was be our allies, and that's where we could talk about really talking about making a different kind of society than the one we have. Not so much capitalistic, but more socialistic.
One of the things I remember about the party paper was that if you opened the paper, there was an article about Guinea-Bissau. There was an article about Palestine. There was an article about Brazil. Your Pan-Africanism and internationalism, obviously some of it comes from the UNIA, but how was that a part of what the party did, that internationalism?
It was important. I think that might have had a lot to do with the party being destroyed, too,
okay,
because of its going on the international scene and us being able to be recognized on the international level by other groups and other countries was important. And it was not only important to the Black Panthers that was back here in the country, it was important to other people around the world, because, you know, we could look to their struggles like the Vietnam struggle and other struggles that people was waging. At the same time, them people was looking at the struggle that we was waging inside the United mm-hmm. States. It was like a process, each one teach one. We was learning from them and they was learning from us. It's just the international world now, you know, and for one people to think that they can just get along by themselves without it having some relationship with the rest of the world is kind of hypocritical.
You know, Kathleen Cleaver was saying there was more Panthers killed and attacked in Los yeah. Angeles and Southern California than in any other part of the country. Why, Roland?
Like I said, what Bunchy started in L.A., was a Mau Mau, and that's what he started. He started it under the name of the Black Panther Party, and he called it the Black Panther Party, but what he actually started was a Mau Mau. And then the only difference in the Mau Mau in here in Kenya is that we was going to avoid trying to kill black people. We was going to try everything in our power to destroy the enemy. We would never give up. We, you know, wouldn't turn on each other. We, all that stuff, so...
When things got horrible, when COINTELPRO came down, when the attacks on the office, what was it about you and Freeman, about Freeman and your working relationship that allowed you both to make it through there, to survive, and to continue to do work? What characteristics did Freeman have that made him and you and others be able to get through a period of time where they were essentially trying to kill everybody?
Ronald told me I always had a way of managing to slip through the cracks. You know, that's only because I really, really relied on my instincts on certain things. And if I had a thought that said, well, shouldn't be here, or this is not right, I'd follow that, you know. And every time I did that, I came out on top. Ronald had to make a court appearance up in Los Angeles at the old county jail, just downtown on First and Temple. It's the old jail built back in the 20s. I was with him, and then we got to the court steps. I said, Ronald, look here, man. I don't think we should go in there, you know. He said, nah, man, I'm going in. I said, nah. Ronald decided to go in, and I told him I'd be outside when he get back. And when they saw Ronald again, they was taking him on the elevator, and they put him in jail. And I had to slip away from over there then, you know. So we took a lot of arrests, but nothing they could ever put on us that would stick, because half of the charges they were coming with, or most of the charges they were coming with, were just unrealistic and untrue, you know, a bunch of fabricated lies and ways to harass the party and to drain our resources, you know, spend all the money we had in the office on trying to bail people out of jail. The whole time I was on 850 and